Imagine, just for a second, putting exactly 100,000 Saudi rials into a savings account. Like, you just lock it away, you don't touch it, you don't even look at it, you just let it sit there for 10 years.
Right, just totally parked.
Exactly. And then when that decade is finally up, you log into your bank app, and there it is, 100,000 rials, down to the exact hella on paper. Every single coin is exactly where you left it. And, you know, it feels safe.
Yeah, I mean, we are hardwired to find comfort in that kind of numerical stability. The brain sees the exact same digits and just assumes, well, no risk was taken, so no loss has occurred.
Right, but in reality, everything has changed. That same 100,000 rials, it can no longer buy the same home it could have 10 years ago. It can't cover the same living expenses, and it certainly doesn't provide the same financial security. The money is there, but its muscle is gone.
Yeah, it's completely hollowed out.
Totally. Welcome to this deep dive. Today we're looking at a pretty hefty stack of research, primarily drawing from a really comprehensive article called How Inflation Affects Property Investing and What Investors Should Know. We've also got macroeconomic data from the World Bank in the mix and some really fascinating insights on fractional ownership models from Osul Gamma.
Yeah, it's a great collection of sources.
And we are using all of this to figure out if real estate really is the ultimate shield for your savings or if that's just, you know, a comforting myth.
And it is a critical distinction to make right now, I think. We're living through an era where traditional savings models are really being tested, and investors are just desperately looking for ways to anchor their capital against all this macroeconomic volatility.
Yeah, the anxiety is real. So our mission today is to cut through the noise for you. We want to give you a shortcut to being truly well-informed on this, skipping all the usual information overloads. You can look at your own portfolio with a bit more clarity.
Exactly, just real actionable understanding.
Right. So looking at that slowly shrinking 100,000 rials, okay, let's unpack this. How does this invisible wealth erosion actually work on a mechanical level? And I guess, why is property historically considered the go-to defense?
Well, to understand the defense, you really first have to understand the mechanics of the attacker. You know, inflation is often discussed in these very lofty, abstract terms in economic reports, but it actually operates as a very tangible, invisible thief.
A thief, right.
Yeah, it is the creeping cost of raw materials. It's a price of steel and concrete going up like 20% in a fiscal year, which exponentially increases new construction costs.
Oh, wow.
It's the utility bill. It's the logistics costs for moving goods around. So gradually, the currency itself simply loses its underlying purchasing power. It just buys less stuff.
It makes me think of like a rising tide. Keeping your cash in a basic savings account is a lot like leaving a heavy rock on the beach. It feels incredibly solid, it doesn't move, but as the tide of inflation comes in, the rock just sits there and gets completely swallowed by the water.
That's actually a great way to picture it.
Right. But property, historically, is supposed to be more like a boat. As the tide comes in, the boat is supposed to float up with it.
That analogy perfectly captures the structural goal of long-term investing. You aren't just trying to, like, magically grow a number on a screen. You are trying to build a boat that keeps your purchasing power above the water line.
Above the water, yeah.
And real estate has traditionally attracted capital because it builds that buoyancy using two distinct economic mechanisms. So the first is rental yield, and the second is capital appreciation.
Okay, let's break those down. Starting with the first mechanism, the rental yield.
Right, so rental yield is essentially your cash flow engine. As the broader market experiences inflation, the general cost of living rises, and structural rents typically adjust upward to reflect that new reality. This gives the asset owner a stream of income that can dynamically recalibrate over time. So if a commercial lease has built-in inflation escalators or a residential lease is renewed at current market rates, that rental income engine basically revs higher to match the prevailing economic conditions.
Got it. It adapts. And the second mechanism, capital appreciation, that's tied to the physical asset itself, right? Like the building and the land it sits on becoming inherently more valuable over a long-term horizon.
Yeah, exactly. And this is where we get into the concept of replacement cost. If inflation drives up the cost of labor, lumber, copper, and concrete, it becomes significantly more expensive to build a brand new apartment complex today than it was, say, 5 years ago.
Because the materials are just so much pricier now.
Right, and because new construction is so costly, existing buildings inherently gain value. You just couldn't replicate the existing property for the price you originally paid for it.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, that underlying math acts as a really powerful upward force on the property's valuation.
Okay, I see. So The cash in the bank is like a glider, just slowly losing altitude, but property is like a two-engine plane, powered by rent and appreciation. But I do have to push back here for a second.
Sure, go ahead.
Because when you explained the boat floating on the tide and replacement costs pulling valuations up, it sounds almost too easy. Wait, so if inflation goes up, my property value just magically goes up too. Is it really that simple? Like, I just buy a house, inflation hits, and I'm automatically rich.
What's fascinating here is that this is exactly the myth that trips up so many new investors.
It is.
Oh, absolutely. Assuming that property prices automatically rise in lockstep with inflation is honestly one of the most dangerous assumptions you can make in real estate. The relationship is not some simple one-to-one correlation. It actually involves a massive collision of opposing macroeconomic forces.
Okay, tell me more about that. Because hold on, if inflation drives up construction costs and restricts new housing supply, it also forces central banks to step in, right? They hike interest rates to cool the economy down. Doesn't that crush mortgage affordability and actually hurt property values? Like, you might have a boat, but the central bank just dropped a massive anchor attached to it.
Yes, you've hit on the exact mechanism that stalls out property markets. Higher interest rates act as a massive weight on buyer demand. The cost of capital fundamentally dictates asset valuations.
Because borrowing gets so expensive.
Right. If a central bank raises the benchmark rate by even 2%, the monthly payment on a standard mortgage skyrockets. Suddenly, a huge demographic of potential buyers is priced out of the market entirely. They just can't afford the monthly nut.
Wow. Okay. So even if the house is technically, worth more because it would cost a fortune in raw materials to build it from scratch today, there are vastly fewer people who can actually secure the financing to buy it from you.
Exactly. The demand side of the equation just evaporates. And this friction, it doesn't just affect the buying and selling of property, it heavily impacts the rental engine we discussed earlier, too.
Really? How so?
Well, let's look at this from the perspective of the listener right now, thinking about their own household balance sheet.
Okay, yeah. Like, if my grocery bill has spiked, my utility bills are higher, and filling up my car costs substantially more. I mean, my capacity to absorb a massive rent hike is non-existent.
Right.
My budget is completely tapped out by just the base cost of living.
And that is the crux of it. Inflation dictates what tenants are structurally able to pay. This is what we call the yield trap.
The yield trap.
If macroeconomic inflation outpaces local wage growth, which is honestly a very common scenario, tenants hit a hard financial ceiling. A landlord can look at the inflation data and demand 20% more rent to protect their own yield, but if the local tenant pool simply doesn't have the disposable income, they will just vacate.
They'll leave. And then the property sits empty. And a vacant property has a rental yield of zero.
Exactly, zero.
The engine completely stalls out.
It becomes a distressed asset. Looking at inflation in isolation, without accounting for wage stagnation or the cost of debt, is just a recipe for catastrophic portfolio allocation.
Yeah, that sounds super risky.
The reality of the market is this chaotic, simultaneous mix. You have rising construction costs pushing valuations up, higher interest rates dragging buyer demand down, and tenant wage caps stifling rental growth all at the same time.
So if inflation is this giant, chaotic macroeconomic weather system, it means it must hit different properties in totally different ways. Like, we need to zoom in from the macro economy to the micro property level, right?
To do.
The article gives this great example. If you have a residential apartment in a growing tech hub versus a commercial building in a struggling manufacturing town, the exact same national inflation rate is going to impact them in completely different realities.
Oh, the divergence in performance between those two assets would be staggering. I mean, how would you model the fallout there?
Here's where it gets really interesting. The residential apartment in the growing community is likely going to weather the storm. The fundamental demand to live near those jobs and good schools is just so high that tenants will find a way to absorb the rent increase.
Right, they adapt.
Yeah, they might get roommates, or downsize their square footage, or aggressively cut back on discretionary spending like dining out. Housing is basically the absolute last thing people stop paying for.
It's an inelastic need, and in that scenario, it's supported by strong local economic drivers.
Exactly. But that struggling commercial building in the manufacturing town, if you try to aggressively raise the lease on a small business tenant who's already drowning in inflated supply chain costs, they won't just refuse to pay.
Right.
They will declare bankruptcy and close their doors. You lose the tenant entirely, and in a stagnant town, you aren't finding a replacement anytime soon.
And you've just perfectly illustrated why micro fundamentals rule the real estate market. The headline national inflation rate is just background noise compared to the localized street-level reality of a specific asset.
Background noise, wow.
Yeah. Successful institutional investing is never about sitting in front of a Bloomberg terminal trying to predict the next consumer price index report so you can time the market.
It's about shifting your perspective entirely. Like, amateurs ask, will this property go up in value by next summer? But professionals ask, does this asset have the structural integrity to support my capital over a 20-year horizon?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the World Bank's macroeconomic data consistently reminds us that inflation is a natural cyclical feature of any modern fiat-based economy.
It's just built in.
It is. It's not an anomaly to be avoided. It is an environment to be navigated. It ebbs and flows in these decades-long cycles. Therefore, the strategic goal is preparing for cyclical change by anchoring your capital to unshakable fundamentals.
So we're talking about things like location, local employment diversity, infrastructure development, and just the physical condition of the asset itself.
Those are the metrics that matter. If you acquire a high-quality asset in a municipality with severely constrained housing supply, but a growing, highly educated workforce, that property will respond to inflationary shocks far better than a secondary asset in a market with infinite room for suburban sprawl.
Right.
You are not buying a building, you are buying resilience. You are buying a hole that won't leak when the economic tide gets violent.
I follow the logic completely. Buy a prime asset with bulletproof fundamentals, and your two-engine boat will float. But there is a massive, glaring, systemic irony here for the average listener.
Ah, yes, the initial capital hurdle.
Yeah, it's a brutal catch-22. Property might protect you from inflation over a 20-year horizon, but current inflation is driving up the daily cost of living right now.
Which eats into your savings rate.
Exactly. That makes it incredibly difficult to accumulate savings. And because those prime property valuations are also rising, the down payment required to actually buy the asset is inflating faster than you can save.
It's exhausting.
It is. You are furiously paddling a rowboat trying to catch a speedboat. By the time you save the 200,000 rials you mapped out for a deposit, the market has moved, and the bank now requires 350,000. It structurally locks ready, willing, and educated investors completely out of the market.
This is, without a doubt, the most critical friction point in modern wealth generation. We have an entire generation of highly educated professionals who deeply understand the fundamentals, who actively want the long-term inflation protection, but who simply cannot scale the initial capital wall of premium real estate.
The wall is just too high.
The barrier to entry is entirely broken, and this is where we have to look at the structural innovations happening in the market, specifically fractional property ownership.
So what does this all mean functionally? Fractional ownership is essentially pooling capital to buy a slice of a building rather than the whole thing. But how is this mechanically any different from just buying shares in a massive, a real estate investment trust?
That is the essential question, and the distinction is actually massive. When you buy into a traditional REIT, you are buying a stock in a massive corporate entity that owns hundreds of properties.
Okay.
It is a blind pool. You have zero control over which specific buildings they buy or sell. And your shares are subject to the daily volatility of the stock market. Fractional ownership, particularly the modern tech-enabled models, allows for direct, targeted ownership of a specific asset.
Oh, I see. So instead of buying a mystery bag of commercial real estate across the globe, I can look at a specific apartment building in a specific neighborhood in Riyadh, evaluate the exact fundamentals we just talked about, and decide to buy, say, 3% of that exact building.
Precisely. You are utilizing a special purpose vehicle, or SPV, which holds the legal title to that one specific property. You own shares in the SPV proportional to your investment.
Right.
It changes the mechanics of entry. You don't need 2 million reals. You might only need a few thousand.
Okay, but what about the plumbing? Like, the reality of real estate is that roofs leak, HVAC systems fail, and tenants skip rent. If I own 3% of an apartment, am I getting a 3% bill when the water heater explodes at 3 a.m.?
Well, not if the platform is structured correctly. The fractional model handles the operational friction. The platform acts as the asset manager, holding back a portion of the rental yield in a dedicated maintenance reserve.
A reserve.
Yeah.
Smart.
Yeah. So when the water heater fails, it is paid out of the reserve. The remaining net rental yield is then distributed as proportional dividends to the fractional owners. You get the economic exposure of direct real estate without the operational nightmare of being a traditional landlord.
which fundamentally changes the risk profile too. I mean, if you spend your entire life savings on one single investment property, your entire financial future is highly concentrated. If that specific local employer shuts down or the city changes the zoning laws next door, you take a massive hit.
It is the absolute definition of uncompensated risk. Fractional ownership allows you to take that same amount of accumulated capital and achieve instant diversification.
Right, spreading it out.
Exactly. Instead of deploying 100% of your liquidity into one door, you can deploy 10% into 10 different assets across different neighborhoods or even different asset classes, like mixing residential with commercial. You are fundamentally reducing your exposure to localized microshocks.
And looking at the research stack, the fact that a platform like Ocel Gamma is actively operating within the REGIA, regulatory sandbox in Saudi Arabia, signals a massive institutional shift, doesn't it? The regulator isn't just ignoring this, they're actively testing and integrating it.
This raises an important question about the future architecture of wealth preservation. A regulatory sandbox allows state authorities, in this case the Real Estate General Authority, to carefully monitor and stress test these fractional platforms in a controlled environment before scaling them up.
They're making sure it works safely.
Yes. They are testing the legal frameworks, the liquidity mechanisms, and crucially, the consumer protections.
It's the infrastructure required to democratize an asset class that was previously ring-fenced just for the ultra-wealthy. Historically, if a premium commercial building came up for sale, only institutional funds or massive family offices could even sit at the table.
True.
Now, the regulatory and technological pipes are being laid to allow everyday capital to participate in those exact same yield profiles.
It compresses the timeline for wealth generation. You don't have to sit on the sidelines in a cash position for a decade, just watching inflation erode your purchasing power while you try to aggressively save for a traditional deposit.
Right, trying to catch that speedboat.
Exactly. You can convert your liquid cash into a hard yield-generating asset much earlier in your financial life cycle. You get the boat in the water sooner.
Let's bring this all together because we have covered some serious macroeconomic ground today. We started with the invisible thief. You know, the reality that inflation structurally and quietly erodes the purchasing power of static cash.
We did. And then we examined how real estate defends against that erosion through its dual engines. The dynamic adjustment of rental yields to match the cost of living, and the long-term capital appreciation driven by rising replacement costs.
But we also completely dismantled the myth that real estate is a magic automatic shield. Inflation brings aggressive opposing forces. It forces central banks to hike interest rates, which destroys mortgage affordability, and it stagnates tenant wages, which creates a hard ceiling on how much rent you can actually collect.
Which underscored our central thesis, macroinflation is background noise compared to microfundamentals. The resilience of an asset is dictated entirely by its location, its condition, and the inelastic demand of its local market over a 20-year horizon.
And finally, we looked at how the structural barrier to entry, those massive deposits required to buy premium assets, is being solved by fractional ownership. Models being stress-tested by regulators right now are allowing investors to pool capital, bypass the traditional down payment trap, and build diversified portfolios without dealing with middle-of-the-night maintenance calls.
It really is about equipping investors with the modern tools necessary to navigate a cyclical economic reality.
Our goal with this deep dive was to give you a shortcut to being well-informed, to help you skip the anxiety of financial doom-scrolling and look at the real estate market, not with uncertainty, but with a structural understanding of how the mechanics actually work. But before we go, we want to leave you with one final provocative thought to chew on regarding those fundamentals.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time today establishing that rental demand and location are your ultimate unshakable defenses against inflation. A prime location is supposed to survive any economic turbulence.
But think about this. If long-term cyclical inflation fundamentally and permanently restricts how much the average tenant can afford to pay over the next two decades, how might future inflation cycles completely redefine what a good location actually is?
It is a really profound structural question, because right now the market defines a prime location largely through luxury amenities, sprawling square footage, and proximity to high-end commercial districts.
Right. But if everyday household budgets are permanently tightened by the macro environment, will the definition of a high-demand neighborhood violently shift? Will the most valuable, resilient real estate 20 years from now simply be the neighborhoods that offer the absolute lowest baseline cost of living?
That's a fascinating thought.
We're talking about high-density, hyper-energy-efficient housing with walkable access to affordable groceries and robust public transit, so tenants don't have to carry the massive financial burden of owning a car.
Will the very definition of a bulletproof fundamental evolve from luxury and exclusivity to extreme economic efficiency? It is a paradigm shift every investor needs to consider when analyzing the long-term viability of their own city's layout.
So take a hard look around your own neighborhood. Look past the current valuations and ask yourself how it is structurally positioned for the realities of the next 20 years. Because as we've learned today, the invisible thief never stops working. The only question is whether your capital is sitting on the beach waiting for the tide or whether your boat is already in the water. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll catch you next time.